Good morning. This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Purcell. Ahead in about 20 minutes, Donald Ray Pollack talks about becoming a writer after working 30 years in a paper mill. His first novel is The Devil All the Time. And later, The Four Seasons Farm Gardener's Cookbook. To mark the 75th anniversary of Walt Disney's first feature-length film, there's a new book out called The Fairest One of All, The Making of Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. It's a book by J.B. Kaufman, who's an author and film historian on the staff at the Walt Disney Family Foundation, and he's on the phone with me this morning. Good morning, J.B.
Good morning. Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Well, everyone knows the story of Snow White mainly through the Walt Disney feature-length film, and this was Walt Disney's first feature-length film that debuted December 21st, 1937, and then began to show up in other theaters in 1938. But really, the roots of the Snow White feature-length film, I learned from your book, go back to around 1916 with the Paramount movie Snow White that a young Walt Disney saw in Kansas City.
That's right. It was a showing that made a big impression on him because it was just a really unusual showing. It came after the usual theatrical run, and there was a big public movie party in Convention Hall in Kansas City. So it was done on a big scale. But he was impressed not only by the scale of the showing, but by the film itself. And later on, when he came to make his first feature-length film, he said that he just considered Snow White to be the perfect story. It had everything going for it, including the sympathetic hero and heroine and the dwarfs, who were great comic relief and were a perfect vehicle for his medium of animated films. So it had basically everything he needed to make a perfect feature.
So what was groundbreaking about making a feature-length animated film? Disney had a lot of success with the shorter works. What made feature-length that much more special?
Well, just the fact that it was one more boundary that he overcame. He really had been coming up with all kinds of new creative and delightful ideas all through the 1930s, and he basically completely redefined the art of making animated cartoons. So it was only a matter of time before he burst the bounds of the one reel film and made a feature which would not only be an added attraction in a program, but it would be the centerpiece of the program. It would provide a full evening's entertainment. You can technically say that there had been feature-length animated films before Snow White, but it's also true that there had never been anything quite like Snow White before, and it really redefined the whole idea of a feature-length animated film.
From the detail I see in your book, The Fairest One of All, you must have spent a lot of time delving into the development of Snow White. Describe your research and how long have you been working at it?
Well, it's a little hard to quantify because I think I actually worked full time on the book for about 3 or 4 years. But there was also some material that I had on hand before that went into it. I'm kind of amazed now to realize that I got into this racket a good 30 years ago, and a lot of the artists who worked on the film were still around, and I could interview them. So I did, and so those interview quotes were really invaluable in writing the book. But as far as the full-time research for this, it was basically divided between the Walt Disney Archives and the Animation Research Library at Disney, which is a separate entity, and our own collection at the Walt Disney Family Museum. And it took literally years to go through all of the documentation that had been preserved.
Well, in the book, The Fairest One of All, you go through the making of the movie and go through each of the sequences in the animation. And I was very surprised to realize how much hard work goes into producing, or especially back in that day and age, just the camera work to put the different layers for the animation. It seems that Walt Disney was doing some very groundbreaking animation at the time, above and beyond.
Oh, absolutely. And that was really his whole thing. He was never content to repeat himself. He always wanted to be trying new things. And you're right, the studio pioneered not only on an artistic front, but also on a technological front. The most visible example of that is the multiplane camera crane, which was developed just as production was getting underway on Snow White. And it made those depth effects possible so that you could really be drawn into this fantasy world on the screen.
As you sequenced the film, I was surprised to find there were some scenes there that were cut. A lot of work was done on stuff, weeks and weeks of work that was left on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, that is the case. I think that basically just illustrates kind of the tremendous grasp that Walt Disney had of this whole project. He was really able to keep his focus on both the details of the film and on the big picture simultaneously. So probably the most famous example is the soup sequence. When Snow White calls the dwarfs in for supper, originally there was a sequence in which they came stampeding into the house to eat this meal of soup that she had fixed, and their table manners were so terrible that she tried to educate them in proper table manners, and she only was partially successful. And it was a great little sequence, and it was underway. It was being animated. But it got to a point where Walt started figuring that it really slowed down the story. It was great in itself, but it slowed down the story, and that was a point in the story where he needed to move it along. So it was a very difficult decision, but he did decide to cut it out. That's probably the best-known example of that, but there were others, too. And it pretty much illustrates his skill as a story editor in being able to tailor these individual components to the overall good of the film.
Well, December 21st, 1937, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs had its Hollywood premiere, and from your account in the book, what a premiere it had for an animated film with all the real-life movie stars who showed up.
That's right, that's right. It was a gathering of Hollywood royalty that night, and Walt and his artists didn't make any bones about it. They were nervous because they had invested 4 years and a lot of money in this, not to mention, the staggering amount of work that went into it. And I think Walt always suspected that the film would be successful, but I don't think anybody realized just how successful it would be. And they got a glimpse of it that night. This was a house full of hardened film industry professionals, and they just thoroughly entered into it and laughed and cried and applauded uproariously at the end.
Well, it had that debut in Hollywood, and then in early 1938 started showing up in movie theaters on the East Coast as well, just as big a hit as it was in Hollywood. But there was a little bit of trouble with the Technicolor prints getting enough copies to get to all the theaters. And then the movie was taken out of theaters, as it happens with Disney films. We've seen the pattern over the years. And then relaunched back in 1944, or again in 1944, with Cincinnati part of the big relaunch in 1944.
That's right.
Can you share the story
exactly
about that?
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, the reissue of the film was a pretty big event in the studio's history, because today we may take those things for granted, but at the time it was considered a real gamble to bring out a film that had already played 6 years earlier and introduce it as a new film. So again, there was some question about whether this would be successful. But in fact, there was a radio station there in Cincinnati that had a powerful enough signal to reach four states. It was called the Nation Station.
WLW, yes.
That's right. That's right. And they and the studio collaborated to stage a big promotional campaign, and it was enormously successful once again. They discovered that they had a big hit on their hands all over again. So, yes, Cincinnati played a very important part in reintroducing the film to audiences. And in turn, that became a regular policy for the Disney studio to keep reissuing their films at intervals over the years.
Well, here it is 75 years later, and still Snow White and the Dwarves are sweeping us away. What is it, the story or the animation or just the magic of all that mixed with the music? Why is Snow White so enduring?
I think it's a combination of all of those things, but mainly it is the fact that Walt and his artists were never satisfied the first time. You don't see anything in the film that looks the way it did to begin with. Everything was tirelessly worked and reworked and reworked, and the effort doesn't show, but the care does. It's just a very, very high artistic standard that they were striving for. And it still is pretty much the gold standard. If you talk to people in the animation industry today, they'll tell you that they're still trying to, or striving to, reach that bar that Walt set in 1937. It really says something for his perfectionism as an artist.
J.B. Kaufman is the author of the book, The Fairest One of All, The Making of Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, celebrating its 75th anniversary. A fascinating book with some wonderful art and pictures, and including the crowning of the new Snow White in Cincinnati in 1944. The Fairest One of All, available where books are sold. You can find a link to it and learn more about J.B. Kaufman at our website, wvxu.org. Well, thanks again, J.B., for joining us here on Cincinnati Edition.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to talk to you today.